Hi, this is Yannick Silver, Maverick MBA and author of Evolved Enterprise. And I have with me my business partner, Joe McClinsky, who's a New York Times bestseller of Grow Regardless and founder of EntreQuest, that works with mission-driven entrepreneurs to help them grow. Today, we're super excited to be able to interview Jack Welsh and Susie Welsh. And just a little bit of background, Jack is one of the world's most respected and celebrated CEOs, known for his unmatched track record of success, enormous love of people, fierce passion for winning, and unbridled desire to change the world for the better, using his unique management practices, which are collectively called the Welsh Way. In his 21 years as CEO, Jack transformed GE into the world's most admired and successful company with his innovative management techniques. Revenue grew fivefold from $25 billion to $130 billion. Income grew tenfold from $1.5 billion to $15 billion. And the company's market cap had a 30-fold increase of more than $40 billion. So I'd say the Welsh Way definitely works. After retiring from GE in 2001, Jack has only become more active in business. He's written two best-selling books, Jack Straight from the Gut and Winning, and now the new real-life MBA that we're going to be talking to him and Susie about in just a moment. He actively participates in managing numerous companies as part of a private equity group. And he's also, in 2001, essentially went into a startup where he founded the Jack Welsh Management Institute, a business school that offers executive education and management training. And he's really involved in every single aspect of the institute. As executive chairman, he hosts video conferences with students, appears in exclusive videos, and is deeply engaged in the development of the program's curriculum. Susie Welsh, best-selling author, popular television commentator, and noted business journalist. She's the co-author of the book, The Real Life MBA. And going beyond theories, concepts, and ideologies, Susie and her husband, Jack, are going to be tackling the real stuff of work today, of what it means to be a 21st century entrepreneur. And when you get down to it, it's really about winning in businesses. It's all about mastering the gritty, inescapable, make-or-break, real-life dilemmas that define the new economy and everything in between. Susie and Jack have also, they were the co-authors of Winning and Following Winning, The Answers. And then also Susie separately on her own has her own New York Times bestseller, which was 10-10-10, A Life-Transforming Idea, the book that presents a powerful decision-making strategy for success at work and in parenting, love, and friendship. And it's actually published in 29 countries. One really important thing to note about all their books is that the proceeds from each of the books are all donated to support inner city scholarships. So let's welcome Jack and Susie Welsh.
You guys have several great best-selling books already out there, from Straight from the Gut to Winning to Susie with yours, 10-10-10. I mean, why do we need another book on business and the new one, the Real Life MBA?
Well, that's a great question, because we didn't want to write a book. We were very happy in our lives, Jack in private equity and me doing writing consulting, and Jack started the Jack Welsh Management Institute, which now has 900 MBAs. It's an accredited online business school. But 10 years had gone by since we wrote Winning, and the world had really changed. It's faster, it's more global, it's more digital, We got this sense by talking to a million people as we traveled around the world, 1.2 million people, we did a calculation, and we thought this book did not exist, an MBA in a box, and people needed it, because you can't go back to school for a lot of people. I'm going to go let her in. You can't go back to school, a lot of people, for 2 years and take the time and give up the time to go get an MBA.
Yeah, we got your dog in background. So that's perfect. So it's like you guys are real world, and that's what I love about this. Because some people are like, wow, you know, Jack Welsh, you know, he doesn't have any issues with his dog or anything going on, but everyone has everything exact same as everyone else. So tell us about this notion of 21st century leaders. I think it's so interesting right now. Susie, you're talking about how things are changing so fast. I think business is accelerating and so many different ways. What do you see as a difference maybe that 21st century leaders really need to think about and consider?
Well, I think there's one point that everyone has to understand in leadership roles, and that is that everyone knows everything. And transparency is the name of the game. And with that in mind, you will only be able to lead with a transparent style that reaches what we call truth and trust. And where an organization only speaks the truth, the environment is truth, and where trust is built over time, and the two of them go back and forth, building more truth and more trust until an organization is open and fast.
Right. I mean, the key right now, what you need in the new business environment is total productivity, total creativity, innovation, open conversation between everybody. And the fastest way to get there, you know, you can read a million leadership books and you can go get your MBA. At the end of the day, it is about having this environment and this culture that Jack describes of people speaking and seeking the truth and operating in a mode of trust, building trust in every different direction. And as we've gone around on the book tour, we've had a great experience asking people, you know, do you have a team that's filled with truth and trust? And, you know, sometimes people are nodding and they're feeling pretty good, but most of the time people look pretty stricken when you ask that question.
And Yannick, when we ask the question, all of our speeches are Q&As, and we ask the question, how many of you know where you personally stand in your company, what your career path is, what your boss thinks of you, where you think you'll move next? And we don't get 15%. We're lucky if we get 10 raise their hand to say they know. The other day in Chicago, this is literally true, in a group called Chicago Ideas, which is one of these venture things, we had 500 people there, and we asked a question, and two people raised their hand.
Two people in the audience. And imagine if you're in an organization where you have no idea where you stand, what your career looks like, what your boss thinks of your performance, how paralyzing it is. And it's completely unnecessary, but you have to make candor a value, and that's pretty hard for people.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. So one of my friends, Tony Hsieh from Zappos, he's, I don't know what number of followers he had on Twitter at the point when we're talking about this, but, you know, significant amount. And obviously, as you talked about transparency, Jack, just a moment ago, there's things like Glassdoors that evaluate companies, and employees can talk about
right.
that. So Tony, I asked Tony, I'm like, you know, you have all these followers and you let everyone from your company, from Zappos, just, you know, tweet whatever they want. And he's like, yeah, I want that to happen. And I said, well, what, you know, you and I go out together, we have a couple drinks, and, you know, what if someone takes a picture of you doing something? He's like, well, I never do anything that I wouldn't want my grandmother to know about. I'm like, well, that's, you know, to me, was a perfect answer. It was like,
that's,
you know,
a perfect answer.
Yeah. And it's,
I think
it's just really,
you want that. You desperately want that culture.
Yeah, well, culture is huge, and you guys talk about a wow team. And Joe, I'll let you jump in here because this is your field, culture.
You bet. Well, and I've been a huge fan of all of your books, guys. And, you know, as I think about this next one, what I really loved about the way that you broke it down into sort of, you know, Susie, you said this practical principles. And, you know, it's kind of, at some level, you know, how many books have been out there that have talked about, you know, be honest, be candid, you know, build a culture of trust or a culture of, you know, good character. Do you guys really see a shift happening? So you just tell this story about being in Chicago and only a couple people can raise their hand. You know, I feel like we've been in this sort of awakening, evolved period where, you know, is it really important for businesses to have leaders that think this way? Is it a nice to have, or is it a need to have?
No, it's absolutely necessary to have. You know, to go back a long way, I'm in private equity now. We're managing 24 companies of sizes ranging from $2 billion to $25 billion. But in my GE days, we started out with a satisfaction or engagement number of 30 to 35% and 22 years later, we ended up with over 93%.
Wow.
And that's an incredible number where candor permeated the organization and truth and trust were a way of life. Everyone knew where they stood. And it's something that's what creates a winning culture. And that's why we're the most valuable company and all that in the world. That wasn't me. That was lots of people buying into that philosophy.
That's great.
So, Jack or Susie, if I wanted to help my team members know where they stood, is that an annual performance review or is that something different?
No,
it is not.
At least four times, 2 to 4 times a year. The more often, the better. I mean, and frankly, in our companies right now that we run, we don't even wait to do it at set times of the year. We do it constantly. I mean, we are always in dialogue, giving feedback openly. It is a constant conversation. Now, if that's not possible for you, two times at the minimum, four times is optimal, and you sit down with people and on a note card, preferably handwritten, you have, here's what I like about what you're doing, and on the other side, here's what you should be doing better, and you have a conversation around it. Annually is absolutely not enough.
And those corporate forms are cumbersome and meaningless. You need an eyeball-to-eyeball, straight conversation with a little note card, as Susie said, and people will always know where they stand. And when the time comes that they don't improve and they can't improve, you won't have a surprise. They'll know it and you'll know it. And you'll also, on the other side, take people to heights they never thought they could go to.
What's the best way to see more of where somebody can go than they even can? How do you inspire someone to go to those great heights?
You give them a vision of where you're going, why you're going there, how you're going to get there, the behaviors you want, and then what's in it for them. And you always have it aspirational, but with attainability.
Great. Joe, do you have anything else?
Yeah, I was going to just jump in here. I mean, is this what you guys refer to in the book as the AOD? The area of destiny. So this is probably the first time I've read a business book that talks about destiny.
I mean, as Jack was speaking, I started to think about area of destiny because that is part of what you do as a manager for somebody if you're a good manager. Area of destiny is a wonderful and very powerful, simple device to help usually individuals figure out what they should be doing with their life. Because as we travel around, we are approached all the time by people, even people who are midway through their careers, who seem very successful and others who are not, who say, what should I be doing with my life? I'm working, but I don't feel like I'm doing what I should be doing. And what we say with Area of Destiny is it's really a matter of thinking about your life as two super highways, if you will. One is what you're uniquely good at. Okay, uniquely good at, better than most people. And the other is what you love doing with your time. And if you intersect those, that beautiful, rich territory, that's where you should be building your professional life. Now, the way that, and we have wonderful, we think, stories in the book about people who really blew up their lives to get into their area of destiny and the incredible upside of it, even though it's not always the easiest thing to do, because sometimes careers happen because of momentum or pressure from parents or all sorts of things. But when you are a good manager, you are actually also talking to your people about their area of destiny. So that's the overlap. I mean, you sometimes can have somebody and they're just not working out, and you will identify it for them. You'll say, look, I don't think you're in your area of destiny. Or you can help them move in your own company into a place that is closer to their area of destiny.
But this is particularly useful for people that got in the total wrong spot, or kids graduating from college under pressure from parents and have to really think through what do they really want to do with the rest of their life.
Area of destiny is very good for preventing midlife crises. So, I mean, you can sort of hold it off, you know, instead of if you do your area of destiny when you're 22, you're going to be much better off when you're 45, so you don't wake up and say, you know, what is my beautiful life? My God, what have I done? To quote the Talking Heads, so.
Yeah. I look at that as almost like you have a cosmic alarm clock that goes off, and everyone has it at different times. It's like my daughter, you know, for the longest time, she didn't have a wiggly tooth, or she wanted a wiggly tooth like her big brother, and lost it, and the tooth fairy would come. But she, it only comes, it's at the right time, and that cosmic alarm clock, like you kind of know it, right? It starts with pangs of that you're not happy, or you're in the wrong spot, or things aren't going well, and sometimes it's hard to make that leap into what is that area of destiny.
Oh, it takes a lot of guts.
It's a lot of courage. I mean, it can be very hard. We have a story in the book about a guy who we knew through private equity who was an executive in Hertz's rental business, and he, on the weekends, his whole life was completely committed to being a triathlete and training people to be triathletes. And to make a long story short, at age 45, he completely blew up his life, took a massive pay cut, moved his family to Dallas, and became a top executive at a big fitness firm. He is so happy now, and he is truly in his area of destiny, and his life had a – but it isn't easy when you're midlife and you've invested a lot of time and energy in building a career, you know, with one foot in front of the other, and then you sort of suddenly realize that I never want to be on this path anyway.
Yeah, for sure. Now, we're going to have new vocab for midlife because we have new health technology coming out and breakthroughs, so we're going to live to be 120, 30, so we're going to say quarter life, one-tenth life, a crisis, whatever it is. But yeah, how many times do you think people will change their path there?
Well, I think it takes everyone's different, but certainly finding that area of destiny is not a simple exercise.
And you know, people will change their careers many times because industries change and needs change. I mean, I started my career as a newspaper reporter. I would never urge one of my kids to become a newspaper reporter today because it's industry in decline. And when you do sort of my area of destiny, my uniquely good skills, I'm able to write. And you know, my career may change over and over and over again as my uniquely good skill finds different applications in the economy.
Right. Perfect. You guys reference the generous gene in the book, and that's the first time that I've heard of it, but I love that concept.
About the generosity gene is because Jack invented this name. He came home from a series of business reviews from private equity several years ago, and he was just on fire, and he said, I think I've nailed something that has been forming in my mind for a long time, and it's this thing, the generosity gene. That is the difference between people who succeed and people who don't succeed. Ultimately, over the course of their careers, the people who succeed have this thing, this burning desire to see people succeed. They get turned on when people get promoted. They love giving raises. They love giving promotions. They're generous. Generosity of spirit and generosity in the pocketbook pours out of them. Those are the managers that people will take the hill for. And so then we sort of started looking around and saying, did this person have it? This person did. And he was, of course, as usual, right.
And when you talk to a crowd of people, they nod their head like crazy. The people they had that were stingy, that were mean-spirited, that stole ideas, that capitalized on their brains, and those that were always trying to boost them up, give them more self-confidence, taking care of them. It's a well-recognized trait among people now.
Right.
Susie challenges my word, gene.
Yeah, well, I just say technically, technically it's probably a collection of genes. I mean, what do I know, scientist here? But I think it's a wonderful phrase, and everyone gets it. You know, that there
we need to start somewhere.
Right.
We'll start
exactly.
With one gene.
Right.
I know. Once you said it, I totally got it because it made all the sense to me in the world, and it's absolutely true. When you do start looking at the people that have been the most impactful for you and in your world,
yep,
in different ways, it's perfect.
And I'll bet when you talk to your Maverick members about it, they will jump at it in terms of, oh yeah, I know, he was that way, she wasn't, he was. It's amazing.
Yeah, and that's, you know, one of the ways that we screen actually for members, and you know, there's an objective piece to their business, but also like who are they as a person, and
yep,
and so that's a big part of it. And now, does this correlate? You know, Susie, you mentioned your kids. Does this correlate down to something that we can teach our children and how to cultivate that generosity gene?
I think that's such a great question, because when Jack talks about this, and you look at an audience, there is sometimes this sort of look on people's faces, and I think that you know, there are going to be some people who very naturally come to this behavior. Okay, they just were raised in homes where this was the example. I mean, for some people, it is a very, we have a good friend, he's our pastor in New York, and he had a spectacular daughter, and before I met her, he said, Hannah brings her happy with her, and then we met her, and she was a person who was just oozing generosity at age 18, okay, and she's gone on to have a spectacular life and career, blah, blah, blah. But you know what, I think that saying that some people are born with this, and I can say this, Jack would never say it. I think Jack was born with it. But I think that if you realize that this is an important characteristic and you're told it and you buy into it intellectually, you can develop it in yourself. Just like people who are not good listeners can develop listening skills just by knowing that they should be listening more. And I do think you can work on it in yourself. It, you can't give up for a loss if you say, I'm just not that way. That's not true. So I do think it can be developed. I think it can be trained. It's better if you're born with it. It helps, but not everyone is.
And also even just having awareness, right? Because now when you have awareness and you're like, oh, that's the generosity gene, now you can be more purposeful in it and simply acknowledge it and be aware.
If you think back to the people you have known, you can identify those who had it and those who didn't.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All right, Joe, which direction do you want to take this?
Well, I'd love to, just stay there for one more second. So I'm from Baltimore. I'm sure you've seen the news recently. And when we talk about young people and we talk about how complicated, what's going on in the world in any city, so teaching generosity is one thing. And I know that you guys are super passionate about your school and all the great things that it's done. And Jack, I've read where you've given a ton of credit to your mom in terms of who you are as a human being and as a person of generosity.
Yep.
What, Susie, you just went through this whole litany of, we can teach it, for people that are willing. How do we teach generosity or character or even leadership at a higher level? Help me in Baltimore. What would you guide? What would you tell me to go do right now, given all the recent things that you've seen in the news? Big question, I know.
No, it's big. I mean, it's
bigger than us, frankly.
I mean,
we don't know the dynamics of Baltimore. We can imagine them.
Sure.
But clearly, they have driven so many people who could have been generous out of the city.
Right.
As I understand it. And I really don't know what you do with the Baltimore other than create jobs. Find ways to create jobs.
Because that starts the wheel turning.
And put real training programs in so people get a skill. We don't have anywhere near enough vocational training.
Right.
We don't have anywhere near enough. When we're giving aid, so much more should be given to training.
There's just hopelessness and despair there. And if people, even I think things like leadership, which is so linked to character, it starts in the home and it starts in your place of worship and it starts in your family and your community. But even if you have those things in place, and we help families and we help mothers and churches and synagogues have robust programs for kids, if they then go on and cannot get educated and get into jobs, the system breaks down. So it's a gigantic systemic problem.
Well, that's a great answer. Thank you. I mean, and you guys mentioned this too, just in terms of, not just your, the book sales and the school, but, you're making a huge difference, I think, in creating, this next generation of leader. And, Jack, to something you said about jobs, jobs and opportunity, right? The more opportunity that people see that they can grab, they can touch, they can feel, they can get to that area of destiny and lift the tide.
And we don't have to start with a college education as the objective. We can start with some real great apprentice programs to teach people how to do things and get a living wage and dignity. I mean, it's so many of the programs we talk about, free community college, free this and other things, that's reaching maybe too far too fast. Mm-hmm. There's some people that we got to take care of the 18-year-old who hasn't had all that training and make sure that they have a life where they can use the skills they have through apprentice programs.
Right. Well, and if I can, and Janak, I'll cede here to you, but I would just say, if anyone's listening and has not read this book, what I love about it is that I believe it's completely transferable to this conversation, right? So I think a lot of the principles being taught about in there are really, really transferable for anyone. So go ahead, Janak.
I was just going to say that we didn't mention because we didn't put on the recording, but I should mention that all proceeds from the books do go, like you mentioned, Joe, is they go to support inner city scholarships, and that is going to be doing the work that you're talking about here. It's like creating opportunity, creating hope, because if there's not enough hope, then there's only despair, and then that turns into what we saw in Baltimore, I think.
Yep.
Let's talk about mentors. So it might be one step beyond this, because I think anyone needs a good role model, because that's where they can see, you know, if they only see the role model of someone who is out on the streets and not being productive, then that's what they're going to see as their role model and their mentor. But, you know, mentors in the business world are a big catchphrase, and I know you guys have probably a whole lot of thoughts on this, of getting a good mentor.
They're a catchphrase, and there's just so much buzz around getting a mentor. You know, when I was in business school, get a mentor, you're told, and
right.
And you're sort of thought, okay, well, I'm going to get into a company and I'm going to find I'm going to hitch my wagon to some star, and then that star is going to sort of carry me to the promised land. Oops, I've just mixed the metaphors, but whatever. But we don't think that, you know, you should just not try that, but we think everyone and everything is a mentor. I mean, you should consider every single person you meet as a mentor in your company, outside of your company, what you read, industry leaders, people whose careers fascinate you. These are all mentors. If you start with the mindset that everyone has a gift and a skill and an idea that you don't have, then you are just a perpetual learning machine. And so we love to expand the concept of mentoring, is that, you know, if you're in a meeting and somebody has a really good way of presenting something that you don't do, that person becomes a mentor in presentations. And, you know, if you see somebody who does a different kind of, has a different way of thinking about business analysis, that person is a mentor. Everybody, not just one person that you hit your wagon to.
And Yannick, this never stops. We're at a communications conference 2 weeks ago. We were speaking, and we like to go a couple hours early to hear the other speakers.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a fellow there from MasterCard who was going through his chief communications officer role now, and how, what a changing role it is, and how offensive it is, and rather than defensive, to put out a fire. And he went through a beautiful presentation on how they now look at every piece of digital media and look at the word MasterCard, whether it be in Thailand or wherever. They've got people immediately catching the connection and reacting to it immediately around the world. It's the most incredible thing. That was a big learning for us as to what they are doing. We are always hungry to find that. And so you've got to go to every event, every meeting, that they're thinking, somebody knows something here that I don't know, and I'm going to find out what it is.
And I do think that one thing we often say when we're saying this to individuals is that we also believe that while you're doing this, that it is a moral obligation to turn around and be a mentor to other people, and to make yourself available for what you've got, to let people learn from you. It's a two-way street. I mean, you want to be a voracious learning machine, but you want to be a voracious teaching machine at the same time. That's just good living.
Yeah, well, it's also proven that when you teach, you get, you know, you go from unconscious confidence to conscious confidence, and you learn it so much more because you have to teach it. And so it's not only good for, you know, just for truly giving, but also for that learning piece. And
our business school proves that. It's the most exciting thing I've ever done. We've got 900 students. We're growing 40% a year. They're all mid-career, 38 years old, average age. So it's the most exciting thing to see these people grow.
And you launched yourself back into a startup. You went from, quote-unquote, retirement to, you know, the Jack Welch Management Institute and
a startup. I mean, it was, you know, just really from scratch, and having to learn a whole industry and its dynamics, and I mean, about accreditation, and I mean, and really to invent a new business model, which is what Jack set out to do, to have a very, very high quality, fully accredited MBA at a very affordable price in a system where the student was the customer. I mean, it's been thrilling on the sidelines, because I'm really in a very sort of advisory capacity, but it's really been thrilling on the sidelines to see Jack, after running a huge corporation, become an entrepreneur.
That's interesting. And Joe, I'm not going to steal your thunder here, because you and I talked about this question beforehand, so jump in on the startup question.
So just as a lifelong entrepreneur, I feel, and really mainly in the small business category, I would read your books and say to myself, man, what translates down to small business? And I feel like this is kind of an awesome moment to ask you that question, being that, you know, as Yannick said, you've gone from running one of the most successful companies of all time to, you know, retirement, to private equity, to now back in it in a totally different way. So I'd love to know, you know, what have been the biggest differences and what's really translated well for you?
Okay, let's talk about what you want to have. In any school, you want to get, in any business, large or small, you want to get employee engagement. Mm-hmm. You want them deeply committed to the cause, to the mission. And you want to get customer satisfaction. One of the problems a lot of people in big corporations don't understand is who the customer is. For example, in education, the customer is very often the faculty. The administrators are taking care of the faculty, and the students are also RANs. In our school, the students are the customer. They evaluate the faculty twice a course. If the faculty gets poor evaluations twice in a row, the faculty is gone. There is no tenure.
Wow.
These are 38-year-old people. They're spending their money. They have the right to opine on the value they're getting. And 64% of our students while in school get promoted. The average raise while in school is 18%. So they're immediately impacting things. They have projects that relate to their work during the work week. So their marketing program, they will work on a project that relates to what they're doing, and the faculty has to help them. The class size is 20 because you've got to have a lot of interaction when you're online. You can't have you can't work all night while your kid is sick and everything else, turn your paper in and get a nice job back from the teacher. You've got to get interaction and dialogue. So we have screens that monitor every interaction between the student and the teacher. And we know how many touches a student and teacher have a week. We used to have 25 students per course. We're now at 20. We may go to 15 because that is the key in the socialization aspect. So we understand the model. It's the same thing that you do in a big company. You want to get the socialization. You want to get people tied to the mission in their skin, in their blood.
I mean, I could, just going up to 20,000 feet, because I observe Jack running this company, I think everything translates. Good business is good business. Good business practices are good business practices. It's all about the people. That doesn't make any difference if your company is large or small. You got to make your company feel small. I mean, I think that one of the things that Jack did so well at GE was he created the urgency of a startup at GE with its 400,000 employees. So I'm not sure I see, and correct me, Jack, of course,
no,
I'm wrong.
I agree totally. I mean, the team with the best players wins. And that's true in a small group. It may be more true in a small group because you can't make mistakes when you got five people.
The only difference, really, is that when you were GE, you just had this huge piggy bank. I mean, there was just more dough floating around for big projects, and Jack was determined to do this like a real entrepreneur without, you know, just to really start it with all the realities that an entrepreneur faces. And so, and to really not have that corporate feeling about how it was starting. And so it's been very exciting to see how well all the principles that we've written about and that he's developed over all the years, at the school, he does exactly the same kind of performance evaluations, exactly as he has done at GE, and they've worked great. So I think what it's been more than anything else is reinforcing and confirming than sort of, shocked by the differences.
Well, private equity proved that these principles that we wrote about in Winning and we're writing about now really work in all sizes because we've got all sizes there. The smallest is about $1.6 billion, I think, but very large companies also. And we have never had a bust in our private equity company, never, even through the recession in 2008.
So you got to believe the principles are working in every place, in every different kind of company, because they're all different kind of companies.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, that really does make the case for it. And, you know, I love the fact that, you know, where you are right now in your career and your life, that you're not content with just sitting there and, I don't know, going out and playing golf and spending your time that way, but really working at reinventing something. And
well, let me tell you something. When we're in this book tour, we've been all over the Midwest, all over the East Coast, and we're going to the West Coast next week with Google and LinkedIn and Microsoft, et cetera. We're going to their headquarters. The one thing that is so clear as we've gone around so far, we've met our graduates. We don't have that many graduates. We've got about 120, 130. You should see our graduates and our students. They come rushing up to you. It's almost tearful, the success they're having in their companies because they're taking this course. It's unbelievable.
So to see the principles continue to spread, you know, it's one thing to read a book. It's another to have them taught in a school. But anyway, that's very
and to
exciting.
See their faces.
Yeah.
No, I love it because that to me, you know, I'm all about the ripple effect, and I love seeing that ripple impact. And I know that is going to be one of the biggest parts of your legacy for sure. Are your students? All right. I know we're coming down here on time. Is there you know, maybe let's talk about legacy maybe for a moment. Is the institute, is that a key piece of the legacy? Is there something else that you think?
I don't like to think of legacies. You mentioned something in the beginning. You do what you love. You have fun doing it. I keep finding my destiny in different places.
Jack is too young to think about legacy.
I love it.
Love it.
I love it.
Awesome.
Yeah, and I absolutely love it. Yeah, as long as you're having fun and that drives the energy and you know, you're continuing
to reinvent.
No, you
mentioned that in your opening statement,
Yannick.
You talked about fun, impact, and fun.
Yeah, impact, fun, and growth. I mean, to me,
that's
rich,
what we're doing. That's the whole ball game.
That's amazing. Where should we send anybody, obviously, to get the book? Any bookstore, obviously, where they can pick it up at Amazon.
Barnes & Noble. It's everywhere, we hope, we think.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. So that's The Real Life MBA by Jack and Susie Welsh, your no BS guide to winning the game, building a team, and growing your career, which, you know, to me are all really great things. And as you said, and, you know, having some fun in the process as well and making an impact, and those are all... That's great.
Well,
thank you guys for being here.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You. But in this book, the word fun is almost on every page.
Yeah, we are really fun.
Well, actually, let me ask you guys about this. What do you guys do that's incredibly fun when you're not working and not engaged with the Institute and all the keynotes and different things that you're doing? What do you have the most fun doing?
I mean, we have four kids. We both brought four kids to this union, and we've got grandchildren. So we spend a lot of time with our families. We have a fabulous dog, and we play golf sometimes. But you know, it's every day.
Every day is a party
right now. So we have a really good time doing everything. We've got great friends, and we're very blessed by that.
I love it. That's great, and it's so wonderful to hear you guys just so engaged with everything and looking for such a brighter future with 21st century leaders and helping be that impact and ripple piece for them. So thank you guys.
Thank you. And I apologize for my voice.
Oh, it's good.
You were great.
Hey, thanks.
Take care,
perfect.
Man.
Thank you guys. I appreciate it.